Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and our environment and our future, produced here in Baltimore, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and heard on Delmarva Public Radio at WSTL 90.7 FM. Reminding you on the way to this conversation that this weekend is your last chance to see The Human Soul and Machine, The Coming Singularity. At the American Visionary Art Museum, AVAM's 19th original thematic exhibition is a timely and playful examination of the serious effect of technology on our lives as seen through the eyes of 40 visionary artists, cutting-edge futurists, and inventors. So Human Soul and Machine, The Coming Singularity, will be open to the public from Thursday, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. before the screening of the Jurassic Park flicks On the Hill as part of American Visionary Arts Museum's movie series. And we have this international treasure in our midst here in Baltimore, where we broadcast from. So if you can, go see this exhibit. You do not want to miss it. We're going to talk today. Today's soundbite is inspired by the piece that I read in the Atlantic Monthly by Charles C. Mann, How to Talk About Climate Change So People Will Listen, in which part of what he posits here is that it's the people who fight around the issue of climate change, the advocates themselves, that are part of the biggest problem, which we'll get into more in the course of the hour as we talk to the rest of our guests. But two of the people mentioned in the article will join us here at the top of our program to kind of wrestle a little bit with the history of why there is such a debate and battle going on when we've kind of shifted in America, but why? And why is there such a skepticism on one level and so difficult to put our hands around this issue of climate change and its effects? So we are joined at first here by Dr. Paul Sabin, who is associate professor in the Department of History at Yale University, author of The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over the Earth's Future, and he coordinates the Yale Environmental History Working Group, serves as director of the undergraduate studies for Yale's undergraduate environmental studies major, and Dr. Dale Jameson, who is also mentioned in the article, professor of environmental studies and philosophy, affiliated professor of law, and director of animal studies initiative at the New York University, an author of Reason in a Dark Time, While the Struggle to Stop Climate Change Failed, and What It Means for Our Future. And Drs. Sabin and Jameson, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Paul Sabin, let me begin with you. I mean, your book was so fascinating, and I remember we covered this book on the program here. And to take us back, before we talk about this a bit about Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon, go back to the beginning of 1970, the period, the late 60s, early 70s, when there was this rush both in government and in the population for concern around climate control, and why there was such a universal agreement and how that dissipated.
Well, I mean, it was a very different time from the stalemate on environmental issues today. I think there's a broad sense of environmental crisis in the country, and I think that that was exacerbated by a lot of anxiety around the Vietnam War as well, and upset turmoil around that. And there was a turn to look to the environmental problems. You had the Santa Barbara oil spill. You had a river in Ohio that caught on fire and became a symbol. And so there was a rush among both Republican and Democratic politicians to try to claim the higher ground on environmental issues, and they passed a wave of legislation in just a couple of years. It got clean water, clean air, a variety of things around oil pollution in marine environments, about planning for restoration. So there's a whole wave of different activities that were happening back then, and I guess the most striking thing in comparison today is what you're describing, the incredible unanimity and general enthusiasm for passing this legislation. I mean, I think it became more divisive once it came to implementing the legislation, because then interests sort of came into play about who that were being threatened by the clean air laws, clean water laws. A lot of money had to be spent in order to remediate the problems. And, you know, the issues did soon become more complicated and much more political, contested.
And Dr. Jameson, how would you explain that same history?
Well, certainly the things that Paul has mentioned are very important and very relevant. But climate change is also a very different kind of problem than some of the first generational environmental issues. It's, first of all, just an intrinsically more difficult problem for humans to solve. And for various reasons, because of its very direct connection to the fossil fuel industry, it was also one that was relatively easy to turn into a divisive issue, I think, compared to some of the other issues.
So, I mean, one of the things here that they posit in the article, we'll talk a bit more with our panel later on as well, is that when you look at the issue of environmental change and climate change here in America and around the globe, even though people are experiencing extreme weather circumstances around the globe, people argue whether or not they are connected to climate change or not, that for much of the population, Paul Sabin, it's invisible. You know, you get in your car, you drive to work. You have a vicious rainstorm. It might wipe out the farmer's crops, but you go home to a warm, dry house, have your dinner, and go about your day. It's almost, you know, it's difficult for some people, so I think it's unseen, unfelt.
Right. No, I mean, I think climate change is ripe for ideological battle because it is fairly abstract as an issue, and the weather is constantly changing, and it's hard to attribute single events necessarily to the change in the climate. And we've always had tornadoes and hurricanes and disasters, and so it does make it difficult. I do think that there's a broad public sense now of some weird stuff going on, but it's hard to know how much of that is incorporating the weather into a story of weirdness, and how much of it is how fundamentally different things actually are. People like to develop narratives around the weather. Another point that I wanted to make, though, about going back into the history, though, is just that our current climate conversation is one that isn't happening in isolation. It comes after many previous conversations, and one of which my first my book was about is that around population and resources, which also were as similarly abstract questions. The idea that the Earth was going to be overpopulated, we were going to run out of resources, and so part of what I say, and I think I want to be careful and just say this is only part of the story, but that that our current debate over climate change is shaped by these previous debates over whether we were going to run out of oil, whether we were going to overpopulate the planet. And the ideological clash that developed around those issues then has transferred over onto the climate issue, even though those two issues are different.
Well, let me ask this question. I'm going to come back, let you conclude with this, Dr. Sabin, because I want to come back to what you just raised that I think is really important. I want to kind of clarify some stuff from the book that I read that you wrote and more. But so, Dr. Jameson, I mean, I think that there is a debate still, do you think, about the nature of climate change?
Well, I want to come back to something that Paul said as well.
Sure.
I think it is really important to see the historical context. Again, I want to emphasize some of what's different about the climate change problem. So there's this issue of attribution that you were talking about, Mark, that we're not very good at dealing with these very indirect probabilistic connections that happen between, say, emissions and long-term impacts. It's very different from a river catching on fire. There's also a problem that CO2 is really a weird pollutant in the sense that it's tasteless. You can't smell it. You can't see it. It doesn't have any effects in small quantities. And again, that's very different from the kinds of air pollutants that we were controlling under the Clean Air Act. So history is hugely important, and I don't want to downplay the importance of that in conditioning our responses to these issues. But the strangeness of the climate change issue also is, I think, an important reason about why we've been so bad at dealing with it. Now, to come back to your question about the scientific consensus, I mean, one of the points I try to make in my book is scientific consensus around certainly the greenhouse effect and what's likely to happen if you put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is not really new. It really builds on a very long history of atmospheric science. Part of the problem we have, I think, with the climate change case is that even when we have sort of relatively widespread agreement that something's happening in the way that Paul is indicating, it's still hard to translate that into widely shared policy goals. And again, part of the problem there is that climate change may kill millions of people. The World Health Organization says it already has, but you'll never read in the newspaper that in someone's obituary that Dale Jameson died yesterday, cause of death, climate change.
Right, right. No, that's true. And I wonder, I'm going to come back to that notion to help you to wrap up this particular segment of our program today. But Paul Sabin, I mean, when most people in this country never heard about the debate between Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon. Some of us did because we follow these things all the time, but many people never did. So how did that have such a deep effect?
Well, I mean, so the debate between Ehrlich and Simon was around whether population growth was going to lead to resource scarcity, and they made a famous bet about that, which is one of the aspects of my book, just to give the background on it. I mean, I think that people who study environmental issues and people who are critical of environmentalists actually are pretty aware of this, and particularly conservatives use the fact that Ehrlich, to give away the story, lost this bet. And they say, well, this shows that environmentalists, exaggerate problems, and therefore they're wrong about other things, and such as climate change. And so I think it's become sort of using a previous debate to then as a hammer in the current debate. Even though, and I agree with Dale, that climate change is a very different issue, but there's sort of been a transference over from the population question to the climate problem in a way that's quite problematic.
So, some final thoughts from both of you. I think it's a very critical question that we're facing. The question is, how do we deal with and address it, which we'll wrestle with, of course, the hour and over the coming weeks. But starting with you, Dr. Joel Jamieson, and go back to Paul Sabin, so where do you think this debate goes from here for America and the world? How does the debate get generated and understood?
Okay, so I think that we need to actually focus on things that are tangible goals, both in terms of individual behavior and in terms of policy change. And one important tangible goal is actually acting very aggressively here and in other countries to reduce and phase out the use of coal. There's been a lot of politics around whether Obama has a war on coal and so on. Well, actually, I think a reasonable politician today should actually say, yes, as a society, we need a war on coal. Coal is just nasty for all sorts of reasons. It kills workers in coal mines. Pollution, air pollution that comes from coal damages human health. And the use of coal is changing climate in ways that are almost unfathomable. And so one way we begin to move to an alternative energy system is by getting away at least that part, the existing energy system.
That was raised in this article. I think that's a critical component. I'm looking forward to seeing what the rest of our panel says about that. Dr. Paul Sabin?
Yeah, I guess I want to focus on a slightly different issue.
Sure.
Which is that I think that the conversation around climate has people often end up speaking from positions of absolutes and moral certitude. And yet the part of the reason why climate change is so hard is that the issue, the climate science may be relatively clear, but the bigger issues of equity, how do we handle risk, what do we do with uncertainty about the kind of changes that are coming, the massive scale of this problem, these are actually quite difficult problems. And I think that we need to move the conversation into a way in which people are doing a better job of listening to each other and thinking and expressing the values that are guiding their positions, because I think that there's just a real inability to communicate and around the climate question, and we have to figure out a way to shift the conversation a little bit towards, and I guess here I am speaking as a historian for the humanities, but towards these issues of values and trying to understand the social choices that we're making about the future, rather than speaking just in terms of absolutes about it is a problem. I mean, it's a disastrous problem, or it's not a problem at all. That we need to move into a more nuanced conversation where we're using our values to choose a path towards the future and a way in which we can listen to each other better.
I want to thank you both so much for taking time out for us today. Dr. Paul Sabin, you just heard, associate professor in the Department of History at Yale University, author of the book The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over the Earth's Future, who coordinates the Yale Environmental History Working Group and is director of the undergraduate studies in environmental studies major, and Dr. Dale Jamieson, professor of environmental studies and philosophy, affiliated professor of law, director of animal studies initiative at NYU, the New York University, and author of the book Reason in a Dark Time, While the Struggle to Stop Climate Change Failed, What It Means to Our Future. Both men and their books mentioned in this article, and both of these books are really important books to read, I think, to wrestle with the issues ahead of us. Dale Jamieson and Paul Sabin, thank you both so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to meet our panel and continue this discussion in depth as well. We're going to take this break with Jimmy Cliff and his piece, Save Our Planet Earth.
Save our planet Earth.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Of course, that, as I said, was Jimmy Cliff, Save Our Planet Earth. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, broadcasting out of Baltimore, Maryland. And we are talking about having this discussion that was fueled by the article by Charles C. Mann in the Atlantic Monthly this month, How to Talk About Climate Change So People Will Listen. We have this very inspired panel from this conversation. Joining us are Dr. Patrick Allitt, who is the Calhoun Family Professor of American History at Emory University, author of Climate of Crisis, America in the Age of Environmentalism. Jackie Patterson, who will be in the studio in just a moment, stuck on this massive 95 traffic here in Baltimore, is director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Daphne Weisham is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Genuine Progress Project. And Mariam Andraghi is the communications coordinator for 350.org. Mariam, did I say your last name correctly?
Close. Mariam Andraghi.
Andraghi. I'm sorry.
No worries.
So welcome. Good to have you all with us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So one of the things in this article that I think that there were so many pieces of this that I want to kind of try to parse out with the four of you in the rest of this hour is the great difficulty to making climate change understood. And there's one of the things in the piece said, climate change is a perfect issue for symbolic battles because it is as yet mostly invisible. So, I mean, I think it's hard for people other than the advocates or the industry who opposes advocates to really make any headway, because most stuff people put out is misunderstood or not understood by the public because of that in many ways. Let me start with you, Daphne.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to say in reading this article, I thought it would be more aptly titled How Not to Talk About Climate Change.
I had that same feeling, but a different one, yes, right?
You know, it's filled with misinformation. He's casting aspersions at people who have been working very hard for decades to try to get the word out intelligibly, and yet he actually offers no real solutions on how to talk about climate change. Just in terms of one piece of misinformation, he claims that we will only have an inch of sea level rise by the end of the century.
Right.
I don't know where he gets this information. Maryland residents are planning for a 2-foot rise by 2050 and a 3.7-foot rise by the end of the century. He also claims that, you know, he acts as though this is the only thing we need to worry about is sea level rise. Well, first of all, just look at what happened with New York City in the wake of Hurricane Sandy with a tiny bit of sea level rise combined with a storm surge. Or look at the saltwater intrusion that's now happening in the state of Florida. You know, he's also oblivious to the effects of vector-borne diseases like Lyme disease, malaria, West Nile virus, dengue fever. All of these things are on the rise as a result of warming temperatures. And he dismisses entirely the ethical aspects of this discussion, namely that we are essentially not only passing on this problem to future generations, but also it's a crisis right now in the global south where the impacts of crop failure and disease are already playing out. So, and then for him to say the solution comes down to hacking the planet, and he says, well, maybe it's not a big deal, but if it is a big deal, we can always geoengineer our way around it, and therefore we should somehow focus on geoengineering as a way of motivating people to act on climate change. I don't understand his line of reasoning. I think he is, you know, he may have some of the environmental history correct, but, for example, he completely ignores the role of corporate money in politics and how that polarized the discussion beginning in the 1990s. He disregards the divestment movement that's now sweeping the country with universities like Stanford agreeing to divest from fossil fuels. So I think he is late to the game, doesn't really understand the science, much less the politics around climate change as it has been evolving, and is confusing the issue by putting this issue, this article out there. It's the last thing we need right now is more misinformation, disinformation, and poorly researched articles that are admittedly well written, but confusing the public more.
Daphne, you raise some critical issues here, and some of the same things I thought when I read the article. But what the article said to me as I read it, and the reason I wanted to do this program around it, was because of the confusion of the Maryland, American and world public, I think. And sometimes it is more than the messaging. I mean, I think there's some very confusing things out there, and I think that you hit on one in the very beginning when you talked about the sea level rise and the debate over that. And I think that people have a very difficult time putting their arms around this because of that. Do you know, you can lay the blame at anybody's doorstep you want. But I'm just saying, I think that's part of the problem, why people have a difficult time kind of knowing what to do. And I think that's part of what I'm wrestling with here. I mean, let me bring in one of our other guests before we go to Mariam. Patrick, what are your thoughts on what you just heard Daphne say in the article itself?
Well, I liked the article by Charles Mann very much. I thought it was very sensible. His main point is that at the moment we've got two groups of people who find it very difficult even to be civil with one another, and that we need to find a way to reestablish points of communication. I think that he's historically very sensible in his description of the way in which previous debates have led to the mutual deterioration of civility and mutual understanding. One of the things that Paul Sabin said, which I totally agree with, is this, that the history of predictions of the future is a history of failure. In other words, in the 1960s and early 1970s, we heard a lot of predictions about how we were going to run out of natural resources, about how the population of the world was going to make massive famines inevitable, about how there was going to be an unmanageable cancer epidemic which would shorten life expectancy. And all of these things proved to be wrong. Anyone who studies the history of the prediction of the future knows that predictions are always false. And so whenever we hear now confident predictions about what's going to happen later in the 21st century, we ought to be skeptical about them. The reality of the future is that we don't know what's going to happen in it. But having said that, there are also some reasons to feel confident as well as some reasons to feel anxious. The discussion of coal, for example, which came up in the first part of your program, Mr. Mann says that we ought to be working towards phasing out coal-powered power stations in the United States. And that's a very reasonable thing to say because it's dirtier than either coal or than either oil or natural gas. At the same time, it's equally true that coal-fired power stations are necessary in places like China and India, because for the first time, they're enabling more people to have to get access to a little bit of wealth, and that means that their health is improving, and that means that they're living longer. Industrialization is the only thing which has ever raised collective standards of living and made it possible to imagine the abolition of mass poverty. And coal is very, very closely related to the fact that people now live longer, better, and healthier lives. So it all has to be put into historical context and viewed differently in different places.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, I'm going to go right to Mariam Odrenghi and continue this conversation. Please join us at 410-319-8888. We will be right back. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM and our sister stations playing this particular program. We're joined by Dr. Patrick Allitt, Calhoun Professor of American History at Emory University, Daphne Weisham Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Genuine Progress Project, and Mariam Odrenghi, who is Communications Coordinator for 350.org. Mariam, let me bring you into the conversation here. Part of the thing in this article, I'd like to hear your and Daphne's response to Dr. Allitt, but it was part of this article was kind of attacking 350.org as wanting to send us back to a time when we all lived on salt, can only win on the sun and wind, and not have the reality of the world as it is today.
Right. So, there were definitely quite a number of attacks on 350, but I think it's really... Daphne hit it on the mark when she said She thinks this writer is a little late to the game. So I think what's really interesting about some of the attacks on free speech is that he also seems to be, he seems to be selectively choosing what to attack. As he attacks the fact that we're talking about only the impact or all the ways in which climate change is rendered invisible, as he says, but I think also forgetting the fact that we do work a lot with communities who are actually fighting fossil fuel projects. And that's, I think, a huge oversight in his entire article, is that he talks a lot about impact and not a lot about causes of climate change. So he doesn't talk about the folks who are impacted by caravans and fossil fuel extraction projects. He doesn't talk about the communities that are impacted by coal power plants and coal refineries. And I think he'd have a hard time going to those places and talking to those people and saying that climate change and carbon pollution is rendered invisible. I think when you can see those smokestacks being emitting all that carbon pollution, it's a really hard sell to say that it's rendered invisible. When you see those extraction projects, fossil fuel extraction projects, fracking projects, and you see the impacts that are on the water and the land as well as on the air and the climate impacts, then I think it's really hard to say that it's an incredibly invisible issue, or that it'll impact people in 2050, which is another point he brings up in his article. So I think what he fails to say in the article is that for him, climate change is rendered invisible, and that it's really hard to just be motivated by the numbers and the parts per million, which is essentially what his attack on 350 is that we're only focused on parts per million. But he doesn't necessarily acknowledge the fact that we are working with communities, and we oftentimes are, when we're speaking about these issues, we're speaking alongside folks who are talking about how climate change has been impacting them now, not how it will impact them solely. So we're often speaking alongside folks who are saying, hey, look what's happening here in my community. And those are a lot of the folks who are being impacted by Sandy, the folks who are being impacted by these, by not only the causes of climate change, but also the impact. So I think that's a huge oversight, and really gives him a space to talk about 350 in that way, when you only selectively talk about what we're doing. But really, as an entire movement around climate change and taking action on climate change, we need to be talking about all those things together. And I think in general, something to acknowledge is when you are trying to talk about climate change is that different things are going to speak to different people. So you talk to some people about parts per million or the science, and they are going to be motivated to take action around that. And for some folks, they're going to want to hear about the health impacts of carbon pollution. They're going to want to be hearing about what's going to be done around the local mining project or the local coal-fired power plant. So really, when it comes to a broad-based climate movement, we really need to be thinking about the many ways we need to be talking about climate issues. And I find in this article, he's mostly just talking about impact.
So, Daphne, let me come back to you before we turn back to Patrick. I think part of what was in this article and part of what Patrick was saying is part of the dilemma for many people. When in the article, he writes that the industry, like the tar sands and coal and the rest, the industry is giving me a future, even if it's a short one. We're all going to be toast together. The world will end in fires, is another person. But part of what made me think of the difficulties around this is, I remember an NPR broadcast not too long ago when they were talking about the new regulations around coal in the United States, and they interviewed a young coal miner in western Pennsylvania who was going to lose his job as a result of the new regulations. And he was interesting. He said, and I'll never forget this, he said, you know, I understand maybe this is hurting the earth and hurting everyone around us, coal, but is also the only way that I can make the kind of money I make and take care of my family, and I do not see anything the government or anybody else is doing to show me a way that's any different. That'll make sense for my immediate future. I mean, I think that really, if the article hit on anything, I think that's one of the issues it hit. That means a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think that's one, you know, in terms of what the environmental movement has not done well, I would say that they have not addressed labor issues very well in terms of a just transition for workers that are most affected by the phase out of coal or other fossil fuels as we move towards a clean energy economy. That is an area where we desperately need to focus our attention. And I just want to point out that the amount of subsidies that the fossil fuel industry gets globally, if we were to shift those subsidies over to renewables, that is the amount of money we would need to actually allow the renewable energy industry to take off and to create the kind of jobs for folks who are now stuck in the only job in town, which is in the case of the tar sands, you know, working on the tar sands. Yes, I can understand if that's your choice in terms of survival. You're going to focus on your own family's survival, but we've got to give people other options. I just wanted to also get back to a couple of things that were raised earlier, namely, you know, scientific uncertainty. I want to point out that uncertainty cuts both ways, and that actually what scientists are now finding is that the changes in climate and the effects on, for example, the various glaciers around the world and Antarctica and so on, they are seeing changes that they were expecting to happen decades from now, happening now. So let's keep in mind that uncertainty can also mean that it would be worse than we expect. And that's why the precautionary principle is so important in all of this. And this is something that apparently man doesn't understand, which is, you know, if you have a 50-50 chance of dying of cancer, are you going to just keep going ahead with whatever activity it is that's causing you to potentially get cancer, or are you going to take some action? We have a 50-50 chance if we keep our global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius of avoiding some of the worst effects of climate change. And we're currently on a path that is exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. So we're headed towards a very frightening terrain that has never been experienced in human history. So I just wanted to point those things out.
Well, let me, before I go back to Patrick Allitt, the Jackie Patterson who's been stuck on the crazy 95 here, just joined us there. Jackie is director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. You've been listening to this conversation, I know, on the radio.
Yes.
And also read the article. Your thoughts immediately before we turn back to Patrick.
Sure, yeah. No, I have appreciated the comments that have been made so far. And one of the things that struck me at the beginning was about this whole issue of how the climate story has been unfolding in a way that a lot of people haven't been able to relate to. And when we first started our program at the NAACP, we encountered similar. People were like, wow, NAACP, what does this have to do with your civil rights agenda? Didn't really see it as, you know, what do the melting ice caps and the polar bears have to do with a civil rights agenda? And so it's been really, for us, going out and listening to what people's experiences have been, sharing the science, listening to people's experiences, and really having conversations about how, whether it's fisher folks and how the salinization has affected their trade, or farmers and how the changes that they've seen in the agricultural yields of their crops, or families who are living in the Gulf region who are seeing more storms, who are seeing more severe storms. So it's really starting with the stories of the folks that I'm talking to instead of coming in with a lecture. And so that's been a critical component to really have folks really have to facilitate a journey of self-actualization where people are really uncovering and sharing the changes that they're seeing in their lives. And that's been the most effective way to start that conversation and really point out why these changes might be happening. So
I'm glad you could join us here. And
sure.
The second time this program, to have you with us.
But thank you.
Let me go to the point, something that Patrick raised was in this article that we've heard from numbers of other people, I think has to be addressed. And I think Patrick raised it as well in his first his comments here on the program so far. And Patrick, that was when you talked about the Industrial Revolution, coal, oil, gas, as being the generators of worldwide income for people and the rise in income and living standards for the world.
Yes.
And if that's the case, it's hard to argue that it has not been the case in the Western world and in the world for the last 100 years. But if that is the case, A, what does that say about the future and where we're going? And is our wealth and well-being in the end, in that regard, to find that way, going to destroy where we're going?
Well, it seems to me, first of all, it's incontrovertible that until the Industrial Revolution, nearly everybody in the world was poor. Life expectancy was very short. People died at any age, often unexpectedly. Childbirth was incredibly dangerous. Bit by bit, the development of mass wealth, which the Industrial Revolution made possible, has created a situation where human longevity keeps on increasing, and we now live in the generation which can expect to live longer than any other and can expect to live healthier than any others. And there's no question that industrialization made that possible. Now, what happens in an industrial society is that it's constantly improving its techniques. If you look at the first steam engines, they were incredibly filthy and not very efficient. Steam engines got steadily better. Then they were displaced by diesel engines, which are better still. In other words, the history of the technology is the history of constant refinement of devices which get more energy out of less work and less fuel use. I think it's very reasonable to expect that we're going to continue with pollution abatement, as we have been doing for the last 50 or 60 years. We breathe much, much cleaner air than Americans did in the 1950s and 60s. But we've got to be careful to make sure that we're doing it prudently and that our regulation of industrial society doesn't itself mitigate or limit the continued generation of new wealth. Obviously, most of the rest of the world is longing to have a living standard comparable to that of the Americans. And it's becoming more and more imaginable that they're going to be able to do so because of the way in which we're becoming more and more efficient at using energy. So I totally agree with all the other panelists that these are very, very real problems. But I guess my difference with them is that they seem to me like manageable problems, and that we need to be a little bit more upbeat about the fact that our achievements have been so astonishing. Let me just give you one example from this week. The earthquake in California, it was a 6.1 earthquake, and yet nobody died. Now, if that earthquake had happened in one of the developing countries, buildings would have collapsed everywhere. The reason they didn't in California was because there's a tight building code, which is earthquake-proofed, and that's only possible because it's wealthy. So I think there's an example of the way in which industrialization, with its use of fossil fuels, has actually saved thousands of lives. And we're so familiar with the fact that it will, we don't even mention it.
All right, I want to continue wrestling with this one point, because I think this is a point that people are wrestling with and stuck on across the globe. And you've seen the climate conferences, Daphne, you've been to those climate conferences, you've seen this debate take place, and this kind of fuels the heart of that debate.
Yeah, you know, I actually grew up in India, and I've spent quite a bit of time in India's coal fields and tracked a lot of our so-called development lending that has been going to countries like India and China focused on coal, and tried to find out where exactly the energy from that coal-fired power was going. And I was alarmed to find out that most of it was going to energy-intensive industries like aluminum smelting, owned by northern corporations like Alcoa and Alcan for export. The notion that somehow we were providing for the energy needs of the poor, which was ostensibly what we were doing with World Bank energy lending, was a total sham. We were throwing the poor off their lands for open-pit coal mines, polluting their atmosphere, dumping the ash in the river so they didn't even have clean drinking water, and then calling this development. Thankfully, President Obama has woken up to this fact and has urged the World Bank and other development banks to get out of lending for coal. And I would say, you know, what he recognized is that, yes, these developing countries do need energy. Of course they do. We have no right to deny them what we've been able to achieve. But they are able, if they are wise, and if we aren't providing all of these subsidized fossil fuel development schemes to them, they're wise to leapfrog over all of our mistakes. Wind is now cheaper than natural gas. Solar prices are plummeting. You know, the rural poor, it makes much more sense to be using solar to deliver energy needs to the rural poor rather than extending the grid. It's far too costly to extend the grid to rural areas. It's much cheaper to move towards solar. So I want to challenge the notion that somehow coal is the only option for these countries and that somehow it's actually improving the lot the average resident of a developing country. You still have power blackouts, just as you did when I was growing up there. You still have, you know, all sorts of corruption in the energy sector, and you know, with distributed energy generation, renewables, you can get around a lot of those problems.
You raised some critical issues here as well. There's so much here to talk about, but I want to get to Mariam and come back to Jackie and with a very specific question for Patrick. Mariam, do you want to have a response? And I'm going to turn to Jackie with a specific question as well.
So basically we've been talking a little bit about jobs and where some of the economic backing behind some of these climate crises is going. And I think another thing to add to, I think it was Daphne who was saying, but just that the number of jobs that are actually created by some renewables and non-fossil fuel extractive industries. So when it comes to coal, oil, gas, and those sectors, they don't actually create as many jobs as green building retrofits, transportation, solar, wind. So when it comes to these renewables and talking about a just transition, you know, we really could be going in the right direction with that.
Before I go back to Patrick here, there's one question I wanted to ask because we don't want to get too sidetracked, but I something I thought about, Jackie, as people were talking, was that some of the people who are often suffer the most ill effects are communities of color in this country and around the world. They also look for the jobs that are taking place. They also, when you see the face of the environmental movement, which is something the article didn't talk about, some people argue one of the reasons the environmental movement has not made some advances is because the environmental movement looks very white, at least in the press and in reality on some levels. And talk about those contradictions for just a moment.
Yeah, I mean,
they weren't in the article, but I think they're very pertinent to the discussion.
Right. I mean, as we were talking about this whole issue of wealth and how industrialization has created wealth, it's created wealth for a very wealthy few and left a number of people, including communities of color and other low-income communities, not experiencing that same level of wealth. So yes, while, for example, the earthquake I think is a prime example of the fact that, yes, in Napa Valley, they had great buildings and they were able to withstand the effects for the most part. But when we're talking about other folks who are impacted by disasters, by the shifts in agricultural yields and so forth, around the nation and around the world, they do not have that level of cushion and that wealth is not getting distributed in any way. As I was driving here, I was actually on a conversation on a call with As You Sow, which is a group that actually looks at this whole issue of compensation, for example, and how CEOs of companies and the executive leadership of companies and to some extent the shareholders are really focusing on keeping that profit margin and concentrated with these big companies and so forth. And so for us, just taking Daphne's point, we are really focusing very much on distributed generation so that we're actually talking about energy democracy so that communities that are currently, you know, just paying high rates and to some extent even being cut off for their electricity because they're not being able to pay for it are actually looking at owning their own solar array or a community controlled solar for communities so that we're part of that shift and not just subject to the shifts that are happening in our economy. We're actually part of it. We're starting to actually own stake in it in a way that we haven't as communities of color and low-income communities historically. So I think that's an important element to keep in mind. And also we'll address this jobs issue, actually building local economies as opposed to always kind of being on the dole and, you know, being a, kind of a line worker in someone else's.
Letting someone else make the money and you're just a line worker making a small salary.
Exactly.
Correct. Who's that?
Could I add a piece to what Jackie was saying, in particular about these local economies? I think what we're seeing as a big shift in Canada is that a lot of times pro tar sands and fossil fuel industry proponents are constantly selling the jobs and talking about the jobs, but what they're not talking about is how so many of the people who are filling these jobs have to leave their communities to actually do this. So when we're talking about jobs, are we really creating about sustaining economies and sustaining communities that can actually stay together, stay with their families, their friends, their loved ones, their neighborhoods? Or are we talking about just getting this large influx of folks to a centralized place? And would that bring an entirely new set of issues, such as issues of forced migration, displacement, alcohol and substance abuse, which brings about more gender-based violence. So there's a whole ripple effect and domino effect of what are some of the social impacts of not focusing on local economies, local democratic energy control, and creating that. So I think that's something that can't be forgotten when talking about these climate impacts and when talking about how labor and these environmental issues merge.
So Patrick Allen, one of the things you raised earlier and then Daphne kind of pushed back on was the question of the expansion of coal around the world, and coal and oil being the heart of development and the heart of where we get our energy and other needs from. And one of the things Daphne mentioned in her conversation was that in her points was that was the subsidies given to oil and coal and gas, and if those were shifted, that could change the emphasis in our economy about where the profits are and where the money goes. What about that response?
Well, it's certainly true that government policy can often affect the way in which energy markets develop. And we've seen many examples in American history in the last 50 years of attempts, of well-meaning attempts to subsidize solar and wind and biofuels energy, which haven't worked all that well. I completely agree with Daphne Wisham when she says that we should encourage developing countries to leapfrog over the inefficient technologies. And obviously, to some extent, we are doing that. There was no suggestion from the World Bank that India should start out with primitive steam engines. But sometimes it is true that the economics of mass electricity production do still require technologies which are relatively dirty. And so then there's a question of trading off the benefits of the electricity that you get with the disadvantages of the pollution that comes with it. As societies get richer, and again, the United States is the obvious example, it can pay more and more attention to environmental quality. The reason America's got such an active environmental movement isn't because the environment is so bad. It's because it's improving. We can afford to make it better. If you look at the history of the world, there's a very, very close correlation between the development of environmental movements and the development of wealth. We've got the discretionary income to devote to improving the environment, whereas the newly industrializing countries around the world haven't yet got that. But it's very reasonable to think that they will get it as they become wealthier, just as they're going to be able to do things like eradicate the diseases which afflict so many of their people as they become wealthier. Industrialization is the technique by which they do it. They understand that perfectly. And whenever they do, in fact, encounter new and better technologies, which ideally probably, in fact, almost certainly will be cleaner, including solar and wind power, they'll switch over to them once they're economically viable. At the moment, on the mass scale, they still aren't.
So I'm curious, given these articles do spark conversations. And so we only have, about 5 minutes left in this segment. But I would like to know where, given the confusion in the public's mind, and we have to admit it is there. If anything, this article did was to say, show that it's there, and I think we knew it was there. Let me start with Daphne Wisham and then go to Jackie and try to get around the room before the end of the hour. Where do we go from here? Where does the movement go from here? Where do we go from here?
Well, one of the things that Mann raises in his article is the idea of a carbon tax. And he says the only way that it can possibly work is if there's a global carbon tax, which is another falsehood I wanted to challenge. There is such a thing as a border carbon adjustment, which would essentially mean that if the U.S. were to put a carbon tax in place, any imports that came across the U.S. borders would have to pay a carbon tax. So essentially we would be averting our competitive disadvantage in imposing a carbon tax by taxing goods as they enter our economy from other countries. So that's one thing I just wanted to say, is that, yes, we do need to put a price on carbon. How we do it, ideally we would do it in a way that is not regressive, that would not hit the poorest first, where there would be some sort of dividend and shift in subsidies so that people could would have access to some of the clean energy options as they're moving away from fossil fuels. So that's one possibility. Of course, we're now in a logjam in Congress, so that possibility is probably a ways off. In the meantime, I think what we need to be focusing on is how much we are now paying and will continue to pay as a result of climate change. I'm on the phone from out here in Oregon. We're dealing with record forest fires, droughts in California that have been unheard of. You know, the kinds of costs that we are paying now will only continue to rise. The U.S. government is bailing out the insurance companies because they can't afford to cover a lot of the disasters that are rising due to storms and crop failure and all of that. So we, the taxpayer, are going to be footing the bill, and we are footing the bill for a lot of these costs right now. And I think if we can somehow make the argument clearly that this is a price we're paying now, it's only going to increase. We can deal with a small amount of pain now for a long-term gain. I hope we can get more Tom Steyers into the political dialogue where they are actually contributing millions of dollars to politicians that are willing to speak out on climate change. That's one other option.
I'm sorry, Donna, I was interrupting because we have like a minute left, and I want to jack you out of a closing thought.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think there's several things we need to do. One, I think we need to get money out of politics. I think barring that, Daphne's last point is a good one. But otherwise, I think in a larger scale, we need to get money out of politics so that we actually do have the people speaking on their own behalf and an active part of decision making. Two, we need to figure out a better way to tell the climate story that actually connects to people's real lived experiences, as I was saying before, so that people do start to see how our energy system, our waste system, our transport system all connects to the changing climate that we're seeing every day. Three, we need to really work on building local economies. And with that, we can actually help folks to see, even if they aren't buying the climate story as it's been told, we can actually talk about ways that, you know, people's energy bills will go down. People can have ownership of their energy. People can see a better access to transportation. People can make money from waste instead of burying it or burning it in ways that destroy our environment. So I think we need to work on systems change, and we need to work on building local autonomy and local economies.
Jackie Patterson from the NAACP, Patrick Allitt, author of Climate Crisis America in the Climate Crisis in America in the Age of Environmentalism, Daphne Weisham from the Institute for Policy Studies, and Mariam Adrenghi, who's Communications Director for 350.org, joining us from Canada. Thank the four of you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are going out here with John Denver, the Eagle and the Hawk. Sail o'er the canyons and up to the stars and reach for the heavens and hope for the future and all that we can be, not what we are, are the lines in the song we're about to hear. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Public Radio is Chris Rank. Our interns are Alex Boston and Sienna Greaves. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes on your favorite podcast app. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.